Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to continue to learn, pray, and act, and on top of that, we also need to make sure we're focused on full compliance with the Constitution. We can't be splitting hairs. We can't be cherry-picking what we need. Because, folks, as we start cherry-picking, then everybody gets to come up and say, well, I think this cherry is more important. If we all back up and say we all demand full compliance, no more, get it right, follow it, and if we need to change, then that's what we can discuss, and if we agree, we'll change. But if not, this is all you do. And so I hope everybody is starting to recognize that Trump may be doing things that are making conservatives happy, but he's not making the Constitution happy. Now, regarding the Electoral College, like I said, I'm not going to harp on this anymore. I'm just going to wait for you to reach out to me so that we can have discussions about using petitions with your state auditor as well as your Secretary of State. So with that, welcome back, Tammy. And so while Tammy looks for that one magical button, so we're going into the 4th of July. You're going to miss the Friday show. Oh, shucks. But the Friday show, I'm going, because you don't know this, but every year I always read, if I can, if the 4th of July falls during the week, I actually read Thomas Jefferson's original draft. It's much longer than what we have as the Declaration of Independence, and there are parts to it that are, oh my gosh, I can't believe he said that. And, you know, he really doesn't mince words. He blames the king, the monarchs, for creating the slavery problem that we have and how immoral they were in doing that and so forth. But anyway, all that stuff was cut out. So, and the other thing you're missing is we've been disclosing how the federal government kind of laid a foundation, and then later on, how they started deviating in bringing states into the union. That was the process of how the federal government got out of, you know, the genie got out of the bottle, so to speak. So anyway, anywho, you may want to catch up. I mean, you know, just to listen to, you know, if you don't hear me enough, you can always listen to the podcast. Anyway, so we're in the Virginia debates. We're on Saturday, June 7th. Mr. Corbyn is responding. He's orating here. And we've got this subject, which is interposition. And so this is where he kind of talks about this process of interposition. So let's go ahead and dive into this.
But the honorable gentleman is possessed of much historical knowledge. I appeal to that knowledge, therefore. Will he not agree that there was a coercive power in the federal government of the Amphictyonics? The coercive power of the Amphictyonic Council was so great as to enable it to punish disobedience and refractory behavior in the most severe manner. Is there not an instance of its carrying fire and sword through the territories and leveling to the ground the towns of those who disobeyed it? Here, Mr. Corbyn mentions particular instances.
Okay, so this
is there no coercion?
So, excuse me.
Go ahead.
Folks, when you see a bracket like this, for those who are reading along, a bracket like that is not from me. It's probably from Elliot, the man who compiled these things, because you'll also notice every once in a while these squiggly brackets with numbers in them. Those are footnotes that he used as well. And so what he's basically saying here is, here Mr. Corbyn mentions particular instances. So it's kind of like, you know, now you know what is coming. So go ahead.
Is there no coercion in the Germanic body? This body, though composed of 300 different component sovereignties, principalities, and cities, and divided into 9 circles, is controlled by one superintending power, the emperor. Is there no coercive power in the confederate government of the Swiss? In the alliance between them and France, there is a provision whereby the latter is to interpose and settle differences that may arise among them, and this interposition has been more than once used. Is there none in Holland? What is the stadtholder? This power is necessary in all governments. A superintending coercive power is absolutely indispensable. This does not exist under the present Articles of Confederation. To vest it with such a power, on its present construction, without any alteration, would be extremely dangerous and might lead to civil war. Gentlemen must, before this, have been convinced of the necessity of an alteration. Our state vessel has sprung a leak. We must embark in a new bottom or sink into perdition.
Okay, so what he's laying out here is there's this process that has been used before, but there's no real mechanism for it here in America, because the federal government, or I should say at that point in time, the Articles of Confederation did not empower the general government to be able to interpose upon the states for failing. So he's actually using interposition to actually, because it goes both ways. If you send out a requirement for the states to pay a tax, a direct tax, because they're getting that power in the Constitution, and if the state fails to pay, then the general government can't interpose, take direct action, and whatever coercive action necessary to get that money. So we actually talk about the other way, where the federal government is doing things that they don't have the authority. And he kind of mentions that regarding Holland, that if France over-exceeds, then, you know, they can interpose. And so interposition is the process of holding somebody accountable to what they are obligated to do. So, anyway, now a little bit further down, he dives into the militia. This is a real short topic right here, so let's go ahead.
Let's see. Oh, the honorable gentleman then urges an objection respecting the militia, who he tells us will be made the instruments of tyranny to deprive us of our liberty. Your militia, says he, will fight against you. Who are the militia? Are we not militia? Shall we fight against ourselves? No, sir, the idea is absurd. We are also terrified by the dread of a standing army. It cannot be denied that we ought to have the means of defense and be able to repel an attack.
Okay, so this concept of a standing army actually would probably, and let's just work through this, because the standing army, or I should say, when the federal government or the general government creates the army, they basically have to federalize the army to basically bring the militia out of certain states, and they're only going to do it where they need to. So let's just say if we're now in the contiguous 48 states, and including Alaska and Hawaii, we don't want to, you know, cast any doubts that they're not a part of the solution or part of the big picture today. But let's say we're abiding by the Constitution, and we realize that there is amassing people on our southern border. Now, if this becomes a standing problem, the federal government can actually call forth a militia of those southern states, and to give the southern states relief if the problem persists for a long period of time, they can rotate in, you know, some militia forces from other states to help supplement or basically provide relief, so that the militia itself is not permanently deployed, you know, those few people, because they got pulled into it and they can't get out. So, because you got to remember that the militia is not a permanent career. It was never our defense system at the motherland, protecting the motherland, America. The militia was not to be professional. Does that make sense? So, when we look at the defense system abroad, that's the Navy. That actually is a standing Navy with the Marine Corps. In other words, that is a profession. Right. So, anyway, let's go into what Mr. Randolph says regarding money down below. Go ahead.
Money is the nerve, the life and soul of government. It is the utmost folly to say that a government could be carried on without this great agent of human affairs. Wars cannot be carried on without a full and uncontrolled discretionary power to raise money in an eligible manner. Nay, sir, government cannot be administered in time of peace without this power. For how is it to be done? It is needless to impress any further on the minds of the gentlemen who hear me the necessity of this power in governments. If so, ought the general government to be more circumscribed in the power of providing for its own safety and existence than any other government? Ought it to depend for the means of its preservation on other bodies? This is actually the case with the Confederation. The power of raising money was nominally vested in that system. In March 1981, even Maryland, the most backward state then, conceded that Congress should have the power of receiving and demanding their proportionate quotas of the states. This was an acknowledgement of the necessity of vesting a power in Congress to raise such sums as emergencies might require, but the means which were proposed have been found inadequate to compass the end. The propriety of the means is alone disputed. No doubt it is the universal opinion of the people of this commonwealth that its legislature should have the power of raising money at its own will and pleasure. There are two ways whereby this may be effected: by requisitions or taxation. There is no other manner, for it surpasses the ingenuity of man to devise any other mode of raising money than by one of those two methods. If the alternative of requisitions be determined upon as more eligible, it will not avail without coercion. If that of taxation be preferred, it will be sufficient without any coercion. If our legislature were to depend on requisition for money to answer the ends of the government, then, sir, the absurdity and sophistry of the arguments urged in defense of such a mode of procuring money would strike the weakest intellect.
Okay, so right here, sophistry is the word.
Sophistry.
That's okay. But actually, there's another way. Printing money we see today,
yeah.
And it's a very immoral thing. It's not an acceptable thing for a government of good character. A dubious government will print money and actually inflate their currency to where they actually are stealing from their people as well as those who they owe debt to. And so the reason why he didn't include that, but he should have, because that's exactly what was happening. But anyway, go on ahead. If the mere pleasure, go ahead.
Okay. If the mere pleasure of individuals were alone to be consulted, if it were left to the choice of your people to pay or not, your treasury would be much poorer than it is. And the advocates of this pernicious policy would perhaps be ashamed of their pertinacity. Suppose for a moment the only existing mode of raising a revenue in Virginia to be that of requisitions. Suppose your requisitions sent on to every county say that money is wanted. Assume the most pressing language. We earnestly entreat you, we humbly supplicate and solicit, you would furnish us with 1,000 or 100 pounds to defray the necessary charges of our government. What would be the result of such applications for voluntary contributions? You would be laughed at for your folly, for thinking human nature could be thus operated upon. From my knowledge of human nature and of my countrymen, I am perfectly certain this would be the case.
So what do you think he's saying there? Even though, let's look at this. In the Articles of Confederation...
I mean, he's saying if you give them an option, they're not going to do it.
Well, that's... Well, okay. Articles of Confederation, it's not like it's, you know, an arbitrary thing coming along and saying, hey, can I have $10 from you? Right? I'm just a stranger. They created a system where they basically created a general government, the article, you know, the Continental Congress, and they basically all said and signed into this document that said, when they give us requisitions, we will pay them. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this is just an arbitrary thing. So when they actually come along and say, hey, you got to pay. And good charactered state governments would have actually paid. So why was it? Because how many times do you hear people describe the framers at this time as a moral people? Lots. I mean, people just
a lot.
They don't look at.
They're basically assuming that everybody in the future is going to be moral too.
Well, okay, there's that. But here's my point: how moral was it for the states and the people, you know, operating in the government of the states, who had signed into and obliged themselves to the union, to not pay those debts? Or even how moral was it for Rogue Island and a few other states, or whatever states that did it, inflate their currency to make these token gestures of paying their debt when they really were just basically giving them paper? So here's my point.
Yeah.
They knew that when given to, and even in these days, when given to the opportunity, people will try to weasel out. And to me, it's just shocking. We look at our own history, and I think the Patriots, in some ways, are a little bit revisionist in history as well. Because they say, oh, they were such a moral nation. Well, if you can't pay your... Isn't there something in the Bible about paying your debts? Isn't there like a parable where, a person loans money, borrows money from their master and pays that master, or actually is unable to pay the master and begs forgiveness, but loans money to, a fellow serf or slave equal to or lower status than him, and then he goes to basically collect and he's not willing to be forgiving, right? You know that story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. About, forgiving debt and how, how cursed that person is for, asking for forgiveness when they're unwilling to forgive another. The point is this, is that when we look at our history and we look at how and what people were doing, they may have gone to church, they may have understood the scriptures, but they were equally fallible as we are today. And they had the same problems. It's just that they didn't have the intense moral decay that we're suffering from today. Now, did you know they had gambling back then?
Didn't everybody gamble? Like, yeah.
Okay, so I think it was Washington, or maybe, I think it was Washington that dabbled in gambling. A few of the framers dabbled in it. I think Thomas Jefferson did too. And they realized that it was an insidious sin. Or an insidious thing, just due to the fact that the addiction, when you win a little bit, next thing you lose, and so they had gambling back then, and it was legal, and you'd think that in a Puritanistic type of state, maybe not up in Massachusetts, but it was legal in Virginia, and so these things were considered, okay. Just like drinking. I mean, we look at drinking as, we went through a prohibition period. We look at drinking as a bad thing. Back in those days, it was the standard. I mean, that's how they survived, to get through the wintertime, drinking grain, alcohol, and so forth. So anyway, my point is, I think that we, the Patriots, are trying, and when you're trying to be honest in discussing history, and you tell people that, this was a good moral nation, and people actually know these other little truths that you've completely blocked out, why would they want to believe what you have to say if you're not at least being honest? Right? See my point. So in mm-hmm. in ways because we have such we've it's like what happens when you put somebody on a pedestal? They start walking on you, right? Well, it's the same thing when you start looking at your history and you become this amorized, and you just kind of look and you go, I just love this. They were so great. They were perfect. They were so good. When that they weren't. They really weren't. As a matter of fact, they had debtor prison. They put people in prison. If a Supreme Court justice on the Supreme Court was actually thrown into debtor prison because he couldn't pay his debt. That would have happened to Thomas Jefferson, but he was at least working with his debtors to where the day he died, they came and foreclosed. So anyway, I'm just trying to insert here that, you know, when we're talking and we're looking and there's way too many people that get in front of people, you know, that they talk about how, you know, how sacred these people were when they really weren't. You know, it's almost like mm-hmm. Israel. When Israel was in bondage to Egypt, people look at, oh, they were, that was the sacred, you know, tribe. That was the sacred people. Well, they may have been God's chosen people, but they were, you know, idol worshiping. I mean, they were doing all sorts of things that they shouldn't have been doing. Mm-hmm. And so, all I'm saying is we lose the argument when we can't actually speak specifically to why the Constitution is important instead of building up. It's kind of like conservatives, how conservatives build up their moral position instead of just focusing on the Constitution. And when you, it's like going into court and arguing that abortion is absolutely immoral. Well, you may be correct, but legally, immorality or morality has nothing to do with whether government does it or not. There's no morality involved in government. And so you're going to lose that argument every time. So that's why we have to focus on you have no authority. And that is the beautiful thing about our system, because we have that. So anyway, that's basically, I just went down this rat hole to try to, you know, help explain. As we look at this, he's basically pointing out, you know, how even at that time, they were not honest in paying their debts. Well, it's not my debt, it's the government debt. Still, you have the financial responsibility to honor that debt. And everybody at that point, all of the states were literally shucking their responsibilities, or many of them were. So anyway, all right. So the next one is the militia. This is where Governor Randolph gets into points about the militia. So let's go ahead and go through that.
Okay. If the spirit of resentment actuates individuals, will not states be equally vindictive? What species of military coercion could the general government adopt for the enforcement of obedience to its demands? Either an army sent into the heart of a delinquent state or blocking up its ports. Have we lived to this, then, that in order to suppress and exclude tyranny, is it necessary to render the most affectionate friends the most bitter enemies? Set the father against the son and make the brother slay the brother? Is this the happy expedient that is to preserve liberty? Will it not destroy it? If an army be once introduced to force us, if once marched into Virginia, figure to yourself what the dreadful consequences will be. The most lamentable civil war must ensue. Have we any troops but militia to confront those disciplined bands that would be sent to force our compliance with requisitions? The most...
Okay, so at this point, we're going into a break. So we'll pick up... We'll pick up a little bit ahead of where you just got cut off. So anyway, folks, he's actually responding, if you didn't notice, he's responding to Patrick Henry with these comments coming back. So that's where these are coming from. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So here is an interesting thing as you're reading this, because Governor Randolph kind of points out that as the militia is formed into the army, now they become a disciplined, and actually they should be disciplined before, right? I mean, when we look at the Constitution, they should be well-armed, they should be well-organized, and they should be disciplined. So that when they call forth, then they would have everything they need. Now, what you're going to notice in here is Randolph kind of points out that the state militia won't be disciplined. Well, they should be. The Constitution demands that all state militias be, you know, equipped, trained, and disciplined. Therefore, not that I'm saying bad things about what he's saying, but the way he's addressing this in the context that this federalized militia, after they've been working together for a little while, they will have a superior operations than the states. And I'm going, I don't know about that. But anyway, the point is that when we really look at the militia and a standing army, keep in mind, folks, that the standing army can, or the militia can only be called up for three things. To create a standing army, to permanently enforce, because the design was never to permanently use the militia to enforce. Only when there was a pushback. And the Whiskey Rebellion is a perfect example of what to do when there's a pushback. You send in the militia, say, look, we have the authority to coerce you if necessary. Do we need to stand here and stand over you? And by that point in time, people, okay. And eventually they kind of get along with doing it. But one interesting point, because this rat hole kind of presented itself, the whiskey tax, because it was such a tax on such a necessity of the day. It's like taxing, you know, a new developing nation with lots of children taxing milk. You know, it's just like, why do you want to hurt the people? You know, why tax that? Mm-hmm. Tax something else. But at that point in time, Hamilton did this deliberately because he wanted everybody to feel the sting of a coercive tax. Mm-hmm. Right? Because they could have chosen, actually, Hamilton, before he chose the distilled liquor, the whiskey tax, he tried to tax the selling of horses. But it was proven that the selling of horses would have not been a uniform tax because there were a lot more horses and horse sales and transactions that were occurring in the southern states than in the northern states. Many people in the northern states didn't even have horses. So, you know, Hamilton was trying to, because where was Hamilton from? He was from the north. He had a horse, but a lot of people up in New York probably didn't have horses, especially in New York City. Anyway, my point is, as he's going through this, you know, I want people to keep context that this standing army is basically just creating a permanent job or vocation for the federalized militia from the states. And so I don't think they ever get into this, but if this happens, does not the federal government have a responsibility to basically backfill if the state, let's say you're grabbing them and sending them off to a couple other states, does the state stay vulnerable at that point in time, or does the federal government provide more funding for arming, organizing, and training the replacements? That's what they should be doing, because who is the militia? When they call up the militia, they don't call up 100%. They just call up a portion of. And so they would need to backfill at least a part of that. And so they don't get into the logistics, and I'll get myself out of the rat hole at this point. It would have been nice to see how they would have gotten into that, because I think it would have exposed the reality that when they talk about a standing army, the Constitution did not give them the authority to actually create an army without using the militia. The militia was the army when needed. They were only called forth, and then they became permanent. What happened with Lincoln in the Civil War is he called forth the militia, then he dismissed them, and then he started creating a standing army, where he was hiring people, and that they basically, it became more of a mercenary force. And so what he was doing was he was bypassing the militia, because the militia, most of the people that were serving in the militia didn't want to actually go to war with the southern states that Lincoln wanted to do. And the whole process of how he did that, just, you know, he stepped on the Constitution left and right. Anyway, let's pick it back up to where he says, if an army be once introduced to force us. Go ahead.
If an army be once introduced to force us, if once marched into Virginia, figure to yourselves what the dreadful consequences will be. The most lamentable civil war must ensue. Have we any troops but militia to confront those disciplined bands that would be sent to force our compliance with requisitions? The most virulent railings are vented against the federal executive. We are told that the president can fix himself in the chair of state, establish himself as a monarch, and destroy the liberties of the people. It has too often happened that powers delegated for the purpose of promoting the happiness of a community have been perverted to the advancement of the personal emoluments of the agents of the people, but the powers of the president are too well guarded and checked to warrant this illiberal aspersion. Let us candidly consider the consequences of the favorite plan of requisitions and see whether, instead of imaginary or problematical, there be not real, palpable dangers to compel your obedience. A rampacious or greedy army will penetrate into the bosom of your country, carrying destruction and dissolution before it. The commander of such an army will be liable to the corruptions and passions incident to other men. If he be possessed of military genius, address, and ambition, he may procure his army, this army, to proclaim him king. Who can tell the result? Who can oppose him with success? Who can say to him, sir, you shall not be a despot? The reasoning, however inconclusive or illogical it may appear to some, is, in my estimation, more accurate than arguments drawn from the possibility of a president becoming a tyrant. Good point.
Okay, so the president won't even have that power. He needs Congress to go along with him, at least the way the Constitution was written. But we actually did get a tyrant out of Lincoln. And Patrick Henry was kind of pointing that out. And actually, during the debates, he actually brought up how there would be a northern president. You know, it's just a matter of time for a northern president to say, I'm going to get rid of your slavery and I'm going to come in and actually free your slaves. He actually said something to that effect. And how they basically laid it out, he wouldn't have the authority to do that. He couldn't do that. had Patrick Henry said, oh, well, the states are going to secede, had he accurately laid out the scenario of the Civil War, then it would have been addressed properly. Because the reality is, if the southern states, like what happened in the Civil War, were being attacked financially, economically, because the federal government was literally using economic warfare against them to force them out of the Union. Therefore, had that, you know, the clarity been provided in the discussion by Patrick Henry, it would have been pointed out that the northern states, you know, were the ones violating and they would not be able to attack. Now, Lincoln did everything he could, and once the southern states started seceding, that's when he basically dismissed Congress. I don't know if you knew that, but he basically sent Congress home because he didn't want to see more members of Congress from the South walking out, because it was an embarrassment. Four states had seceded, and there were, you know, other states that were in the queue to secede. He knew this was going to happen. So he dismissed Congress, and he basically declared martial law, which he had no authority to do. And he called forth the militia. Then he dismissed the militia, and as he was being a tyrant, Supreme Court Justice Taney basically says, what you're doing is unconstitutional. And then he took his long, bony finger and probably put it in Taney's chest and said, I'd like to see you enforce that. I mean, he was a real tyrant. Anyway, so down a little further, he then talks about this important role of the sheriffs.
Let us consider this dispassionately, and whether the idea be well-founded, which is suggested that a conflict will frequently happen between the state and congressional collector for property seized and claimed by both. Though there be no necessity, a strong temptation to increase the present number of officers, no addition will be made to them. Congress will have every inducement, and from the mode of their appointment must be inclined to lighten the burdens of the people. They can derive no advantage from contrary conduct in other countries, where the fate of the poor is wretched, officers are created merely for the emolument of certain individuals. But by the structure of this government, the interests of the people must always be considered, nor will any but necessary officers be created. The number of officers and their compensations will be as inconsiderable as the nature of their business will admit of. With respect to collectors of the general taxes, I have not the least doubt that Congress will employ the state officers and sheriffs, because it will be economical and agreeable to the people. A considerable sum will be saved by it. They will employ such men, Mr. Chairman, unless they determine to throw away the public money in an unjustifiable manner.
And that's what happened. When they started collecting taxes, they created a federal marshal to go around and interface with the different sheriffs throughout either a state or throughout a region of a state if the state was big. That way, everybody kind of had a job, and they kind of knew, you know, okay, I need to collect taxes, and sheriff, I need you to do that. And then they would go around, and they would identify what the taxes should be, because if it's an excise tax, they basically have to tax, you know, like in the liquor, how many gallons you sold or whatever the taxing rate was in the volume of what was sold, then you needed to pay this much in tax. And then that way, they had a mechanism without creating the IRS. The marshals were the ones that actually just interfaced. They weren't really the collectors. I think that the taxes ended up having to go up to the state. They may have been directly out of the county, but I think they technically probably should have been accumulated up to the state so that the state understood, you know, what was being paid. Because the taxes, the real interface is with the state. The federal government interfaces with the state to directly interface, you know, for payment and everything else. It's one to put an officer out there, like a marshal, to help coordinate and to do the bookkeeping, that type of thing. But anyway, so Madison then steps up because Governor Randolph sits down, and Madison kind of goes into a few little things, and one of the things he talks about is sovereignty. And then he goes into the safety of the Union. So let's read this little snippet. It's short.
Okay. A government which relies on 13 independent sovereignties for the means of its existence is a solecism in theory and a mere nullity in practice. It is consistent with reason that such a government can promote the happiness of any people. It is subversive of every principle of sound policy to trust the safety of a community with a government totally destitute of the means of protecting itself or its members.
So the key here is the 13 independent sovereignties. There's no relationship that the states are subservient to the federal government. They're independent sovereigns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's key because as we move into admitting new states, all the states should be independent sovereigns. But that started changing by 1816. And if you listen to what I've been covering over the enabling acts and all of these things of how the federal government started manipulating states coming into the Union, they started losing their independence and their sovereignty. So let's go ahead and dive into the next one, safety in the Union.
Okay. Mr. Madison then recapitulated many instances of the prevalent persuasion of the wisest patriots of the states that the safety of all America depended on union, and that the government of the United States must be possessed of an adequate degree of energy, or that otherwise their connection could not be justly denominated a union. He likewise enumerated the expedients that had been attempted by the people of America to form an intimate association from the meeting at New York in the year 1754 downwards, that their sentiments on this subject had been uniform both in their colonial and independent conditions, and that a variety of causes had hitherto prevented the adoption of an adequate system.
It's interesting that kind of history was known at least that many years later. It's not like they had computers. So they must have really valued the written, you know, the written notes, the written, you know, documents and so forth. And obviously he read up on these things. So now we go into the next day. Mr. Henry, who's an anti-federalist, actually talks about the militia. And so this is an anti-federalist assertion of how he sees the militia behaving, or how the general government will behave with them. Go ahead.
The clause which says that Congress shall provide for arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers, seemed to put the states in the power of Congress. I wish to be informed, if Congress neglected to discipline them, whether the states were not precluded from doing it. Not being favored with a particular answer, I am confirmed in my opinion that the states have not the power of disciplining them without recurring to the doctrine of constructive implied powers. If, by implication, the states may discipline them, by implication also Congress may officer them, because in a partition of power each has a right to come in for part, and because implications is to operate in favor of Congress on all occasions where their object is the extension of power as well as in favor of the states. We have not one-fourth of the arms that would be sufficient to defend ourselves. The power of arming the militia and the means of purchasing arms are taken from the states by the paramount powers of Congress. If Congress will not arm them, they will not be armed at all. There have been no instances shown of a voluntary cession of power sufficient to induce me to grant the most dangerous power a possibility of their future relinquishment will not persuade me to yield such powers. Congress, by the power of taxation, by that of raising an army, and by their control over the militia have the sword in one hand and the purse in the other. Shall we be safe without either? Congress have an unlimited power over both. They are entirely given up by us. Let him candidly tell me, where and when did freedom exist when the sword and purse were given up from the people? Unless a miracle in human affairs interposed, no nation ever retained its liberty after the loss of the sword and purse. Can you prove by any argumentative deduction that it is possible to be safe without retaining one of these?
Okay, so here's a good point. He's basically pointing out that they can call up the militia, even if he's not providing for, or if the federal government is not providing for arming and disciplining them. So what he's creating is a paradox. If the federal government doesn't, because that's what he lays out, if the federal government doesn't spend the money in preparing the militia, then what kind of militia are they going to get when they pull them up without any discipline, without arms, and so forth? Are they going to be a formidable force to basically wage tyranny upon the states? Not at all. If the federal government comes along and basically ignores this, because he lays it out here, they are the ones that have to pay for the training. They have to pay for the arming and the disciplining, even though, and he even cited it, that it would be done by the states. They pay for it, but right. The states control the training. They control the selection of officers and so forth. And he's basically trying to butter his bread on all six sides. Because as we look at, if they are coming for taxes and the states go, hold on here, you're coming and asking us for taxes, but you're not paying us for the militia. You owe us money for the militia. Right. We will take the money that we should be paying you. So that, because if they take that type of turn, if the federal government comes along and takes that type, because where are they going to get their enforcement? They have to get the enforcement from the states. In other words, they have to call up the militia. So let me just start at the beginning. The federal government ignores taking care of the militia and doing what they are doing, and they start spending money on things they shouldn't be spending money on. And the states are none the wiser. They don't know. They're not really, you know, hip with what's going on. Hip, you know, back in the 60s. And so, okay, so now they come along and say, hey, you need to give us taxes, you know, and we're levying these direct taxes upon the states. And the states would actually be able to look and go, hold on here. You're taxing us for something we have no idea where the money's going, but we do know that you're supposed to be paying for the arming, equipping, and training of the militia. Ergo, you need to start giving us money instead of us giving you money. And that the state should, at that point, start pushing back and saying, you owe us this money. And as a matter of fact, since you're not doing it, we're going to do it, we're going to pay for it, and then you're going to owe us the money. And basically bill them, because by contract, by the Constitution, they are liable to pay that. And so when the federal government comes along and says, hey, well, we're going to levy these requisitions upon you, and go, well, what are those requisitions for? You have a responsibility of telling us exactly where that money is going. What are you spending that money on? Because that's in the Constitution as well. That every time they actually lay out a tax, they have one have to make up the revenue for it and the purpose of it. So if you really look at it, what he's creating is he's creating a straw man argument. There's really nothing here. He's making something out of nothing, because the states have the authority to push back and say, hold on, you're not getting the militia, and you're not getting any money. You've been ignoring this responsibility, and now you owe us money. And if you don't pay, then we will interpose on your butt. Because we will all send the armies, or basically we'll send our militias to D.C. and get the money from the Treasury. Because who has the physical force, who has the army or the militia? They don't have to surrender the militia if the federal government has ignored their responsibilities to say, hold on here, you know, we have a militia. It's well disciplined and well trained and equipped because we've been paying for it, and you need to pay us for it. And by if this went into a international court, or if the states basically pulled together in the tribunal, like Madison talks about, because it shouldn't even go into an international court, it would probably go into international, you know, reporting to, you know, the nations of the world to say, you know, we, the states, have basically had to go in and interpose and have had to chastise and admonish our general government because of some of their actions. Just advising that you be aware of this, because there's going to be a good likelihood that they'll owe them money too. And so anyway, so that way everything's on the up and up. But what he's saying here is literally a red herring, a straw man's argument. It's dead. Nothing there. So now Mr. Lee of Westmoreland brings this up and he starts talking about it. And but I don't think he addresses it the way I just did, because I've been reading this and actually I have the advantage because I've lived through their debates and I've been able to find what they missed the first time. Because nine times when you go through, you're hearing everybody saying this and saying that, and they're just responding. Well, now I have insight, or you know what they say, hindsight being 20/20. Right? Armchair quarterbacking, whatever you want to call it. You know, I'm obviously at a level of information that I can actually address this even better than probably the way they addressed it. But let's go ahead. You got, actually, you got 1.5 minutes. So I don't think that it's worth, because this is kind of a long section. And so it's probably not worth doing this. So what I said, that makes sense, right? I mean, Patrick Henry is trying to create this fear-mongering to get everybody to believe that, you know, once you create this federal government, it is your king. It's going to, you know, trample on your liberties, your sovereignty, and it's just going to destroy us. And that wasn't the case. As a matter of fact, it took a while for the federal government to finally figure out how to start playing a Ponzi scheme, because that's really what they did in getting out from underneath the Constitution. Because we talk about the inability for the federal government to be involved in roads, highways, and everything else, and how Madison, Monroe, and Jackson vetoed those attempts. Well, they used the admission of states one at a time to actually start creating public lands. And as we just, you know, kind of read on Monday, this concept of public lands in 1789, that concept had nothing to do with actual public lands within states. It was public lands of the territories and how they were preparing the public lands of the territories to be transitioned into state land. And so this, what I'm covering is really, really good stuff. You know, and I'm not patting myself on the back here, but bottom line, you know, we're exposing things historically that nobody's ever tied to, you know, this problem that we have of a runaway government. So thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great Independence Day tomorrow. And folks, I hope everybody has a good Independence Day. We will be back in covering the draft or the real Declaration of Independence before it was chopped up for political correctness. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email.
Thank you.